Thank you. It seems like every time I do a lecture or something, I get sick. But I just have a little touch of laryngitis, so I have my lozenge here in case I need it. And if I get weak, then I'll sit down. But so far, just keep your fingers crossed. Thank you for coming tonight. How many of you, just by a raise of hand and say yes, have been to previous lectures? Okay, yeah, of mine. Now, many of you that know my story know quite a bit about. Oh, let's do how many haven't been. Raise your hand and say no. Okay, so probably half and half. Okay, I'm going to basically cover my near-death story, but there are parts tonight that I won't be covering the future world events, but I will on the radio show on Friday. I'd like to just basically tell you what happened. How this all came about. Growing up as a child, I lived in a real dysfunctional family. We moved dozens and dozens of times throughout my childhood and early years. My father had a very violent temper and, at the drop of a hat, could knock one of us down, or he was pretty violent. So I grew up scared of everything, afraid to say anything for fear I could be hit by him. There were times when I was a child, I dropped a drop of ice cream on an old brown couch we had, and before I even knew what I had done, my father was beating me in the head until I was unconscious. I was about 10. I saw my father try to kill my mother when I was 8 years old. So, just to give you a little bit of a background, it certainly doesn't cover everything. I learned in my early years that my father was a pedophile, and it was one of the reasons why we had moved so many times so that he could escape any kind of prosecution or anything. So, it wasn't very fun, not a very fun lifestyle. Black isn't a very spiritual color, but I wore it tonight so I wouldn't look so fat. I'm on a diet. I thought maybe it'll make me look a little thinner, but I am legally blind and it's hard for me to walk without falling down, so forgive my appearance. But anyway, tough childhood. From the time I was 8 years old, I had a little neighborhood boy came and told me that if you wished on the first star that came out at night or on a full moon, your wish would come true. Now, we had no money. At this time, I lived in a real rundown apartment in South Los Angeles. That's where I spent most of my childhood, which, if any of you know, it's not a good area, South and East Los Angeles. I wanted a Barbie doll so bad because all the little girls in the neighborhood had Barbie dolls. But we couldn't afford to get one. So you would think I would sit out on the porch and wish for a Barbie doll. But at 8 years old, I sat out in front of our apartment and wished that my father would die. Every single night, I would see the sun going down and I would go sit out on the porch and wish that he would die. So even as a child, I couldn't stand to be around him. I stayed away from him because I was afraid of him. Anyway, this hatred and feelings for him grew as I became a teenager. I lived in seven different foster homes because of my mother was afraid that he would hurt me as a child, hurt me other than physically. And so I didn't live a lot with my mother when I was younger. When I was about 14, my sister and I were talking about maybe fixing his car. So he would crash over. At the time, we lived in Simi Valley, California, and he had to drive over the windy Santa Susana Pass. And there had been times where he would drive so fast and around these curves. He was having an argument with my mother, and he drove his car to the edge of a cliff, and he had one foot on the gas to where rocks were flying and one on the brake and screaming and cursing that he was going to drive the car over a cliff. So my friend an assistant, she can tell you I cannot even stand to drive in a car that goes over, what, 40 miles an hour. Still have fears today from my childhood. But this hate for my father grew and grew, didn't stop. When I turned 18 and had been in my seventh foster home, a young man that came from a very wealthy family, a very attractive young man, and came from this wonderful family, wanted to marry me, and I wasn't in love with him, but I jumped at the chance. I was tired of living with other people and being moved around and wanted some kind of stability. About a year, close to a year after we were married, I was expecting my first child. Shortly before he was born, about 2 weeks before he was born, my mother called. She said that they were separated at the time. My parents married and divorced three different times and were separated even at the time of my birth, dozens of times growing up. He was a heavy womanizer. Although we had no money and a lot of times had very little food, she would find thank you letters in the mail for the expensive watch or whatever, spending money on women. And while we were starving in the sixth grade, I passed out and they diagnosed me as malnutritioned. I was only 60 pounds. So I really hated him. And my mother, at the time they were divorced and my mother had moved to Utah. My father was still in California and he called her and said, I'm dying of cancer. Could you take care of me? And my mother was such a good Christian woman. She said yes, even though she was afraid of him and he'd made her life miserable. I won't go into telling you all the things that he did to the kids and the family and to her, but she took him in and was taking care of him up until the time that he was close to die, and then he had to go into a facility. Well, at this point, my mother said, he's only got a short time to live. So even though I was 9 months pregnant and about to deliver, I flew from Denver to Salt Lake to come to Orem to see him in the hospital before he died. Not because I wanted to see him before he died. I wanted to tell him how much I hated him. And so I did. I walked into the room and I was shocked to see how frail and how awful he looked. I stood a distance from the end of the bed and he held out his arms to me and said, can I have a tissue? I've told this story so many times, but I told him how much I hated him. And I was glad he was dying, even as he was holding his arms out to me and asking me to forgive him. I told him I'd never forgive him. I hated him. I was glad he was in pain. I was glad he was dying. I told him how he had ruined my life and that when he died, I would never visit his grave. As soon as he died, he would come to my remembrance no more. Well, I returned to Colorado feeling pretty justified, pretty good about myself, because I knew he couldn't hurt me anymore. This is important to my near-death experience. For me, it was the most profound part of my near-death experience. So when I returned to Denver a couple of weeks later, right before my first son was born, I got a telegram in the mail saying, Daddy died this morning. I didn't shed a tear. I was so relieved that he couldn't hurt me. He couldn't hurt my mother or my sisters anymore. Well, I thought I could make something of my life after that because I blamed him for every mistake and failure. But what I found out is I kept making mistakes, very bad mistakes, and I had no one to blame but myself anymore. I kept making horrendous mistakes, and life didn't get any better. Without going into all the things that happened in my life, just one tragedy, one thing after another. I was living in a little apartment on Doheny Drive. The next street over was Beverly Hills, and my street was Hollywood. It was right there on the border in a little single apartment with then three children, with the Murphy bed that came down out of the wall. I didn't have a car or anything, and I was cleaning houses for people in Beverly Hills, Bel Air, and the man that owned the apartment building where I lived was a Middle Eastern man, and he offered me a job serving at big houses, big parties at his house in Bel Air. So I thought that was a gift from God. All the time I was growing up, I would have situations happen where I didn't believe in God because so many things had happened, and I'd try praying. My mother would say, there is a God and you've got to have faith. I tried that so many times, and it was like, if there is a God, he doesn't like me and he doesn't answer my prayers. It's like, I didn't feel like I was worthy. So anyway, this man, I worked at his home a few times, and then he approached me. He owned the building where I lived. He approached me and said, my brother is very attracted to you, and he wants to sleep with you. And I was like, I was going to make a terrible joke and say, stand in line. I was very pretty back. I was very pretty back in those days, a long time ago. That was inappropriate. But anyway, I said, well, I don't do things like that. And anyway, the conversation went on, and he said, well, if you don't, we can have you killed. So I was sitting out on the front porch the night after this party, crying, crying, crying. And a limousine pulled up in front of the apartment, and this man approached me and said, are you okay? And I told him the story. And he said, well, my girlfriend and I have a big estate in Bel Air, and we have a baby together, and I'll pay you $2,500 a month, which was big money back then, to come live in our home and take care of our infant. And I was a gourmet cook. That's basically how I made a living. And so I thought, oh, maybe there is a God. This is great. And I was like, oh, forgive me for doubting. And I thought this was the answer to my prayers and everything. So I went to live with them. And the first week of being there, he and his lady friend went out for the evening and left me there with the baby. I had sent my children to live with other people trying to save money so I could move them up to Utah, get them out of LA. I thought even if I worked for them 1 month, I would have enough money to get out of there. Well, I was talking to my foster sister on the phone, and I heard someone pick up a phone. And there was no one else in the house, and I knew she only had one phone. And I was like, Joanne, I think someone's in the house. And then they said, hang up the phone or we'll cut your throat. So I ran out of the house, leaving the baby in the nursery. Now, in California, I don't know how many of you have lived in California. Not everybody wants to open their doors when you're screaming for help because they're scared. They don't know what's going on. So I ran across the street and was banging. Nobody would answer. And the same, a few houses down, and a van was coming down the street. And I told them what was happening. They called the police. And within minutes, there were police helicopters and police cars, because a few weeks before, if you remember the news that far back, so long ago, a family that was going to testify against Palestinian family or whatever, the whole family was killed because the parents were supposed to testify in this trial. So the police, I mean, they were all over. I thought, they're not just doing this because, you know, these guys called for help. Well, what they discovered is he was one of the biggest cocaine dealers in Hollywood. So there I was, like, I've got to get out of here. He was arrested. I had no place to go. Well, one of his clients that used to buy cocaine from him, said you can stay at my place, no strings attached, until you can get a job, get on your feet, figure out what you're going to do. Well, there's another prayer that sure didn't go right. So I was at his house for a few days and discovered a large bag of cocaine. Now, with all the faults that I had growing up, which is in my book, I never in my life did drugs or alcohol, just never had a desire to try anything, didn't want to. And I found this large bag of cocaine. I thought, okay, this guy's been buying cocaine from this producer's house that I just escaped from that. I didn't know how much that stuff was worth or whatever. I flushed it down the toilet. So when he came home and he couldn't find it, he wondered where it was. And I told him, and he shoved me. I hit my head against the fireplace in his home, and he stormed out. That day, I was vacuuming, you know, because I told him I'd kind of keep his house up or cook for him in exchange for letting me stay there for a little bit until I could figure out where I was going to go. I never had been paid from the house where this happened because it happened before I got a paycheck. And I started thinking about my whole life, my childhood, everything that I tried to do to improve my life. It always turned sour. I was getting angry and then upset, and I was vacuuming and I was weeping, and I just started talking out loud saying, my life is never gonna, it's never gonna get better. My children deserve better than this. I just couldn't stand it anymore. I just saw everything I try to do is a disaster. Months before, I had been roller skating in around where I lived. I can't even walk now, but I did used to roller skate. And I sprained my ankle quite severely. And the doctor gave me a large bottle of codeine, Tylenol with codeine. But I didn't take it because I didn't want to take any kind of a drug at all. But I kept the bottle for some reason. I kept getting more and more upset. So I just got to the point where I thought, life is too hard. I can't take it anymore. My whole life has been a mess. And so I took the whole bottle. He had some stuff in the cupboard. I don't remember what it was. And I took some of that too. And apparently, as I became more out of it, it didn't take too long. I didn't find out until after, but I called my sister, Deborah. I'm not real close with any of my sisters. And I said a strange thing. I said, my speech was slurred, and I said, tell mother I love her and I forgive her. I thought my mother never did, never said a bad word in her life. She was sweet and abused herself, and I didn't understand why I said that. I thought years later, maybe I felt like she could have done more to protect us, but she did everything she could. Every time she left him, he threatened to kill her or us, and she had no choice but to go back to him. But that's what I said, and not responding to her anymore or hearing that my language was slurred, she called the LA Police Department. Well, the next thing I know, I hear this bang, 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 bang on the door, bang, 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 open the door. I'm hearing it, but not realizing what was going on. Well, they kick the door in because I didn't answer, and I see them rush over to something on the floor, and it was my body. I was above the ceiling looking down, and it was so curious. I'm like, I'm right here. You know, it was very odd. At the same time, I could see through the walls and see them going through the room trying to find out what I had done. They found my pouch that had my insulin things in it. I've been a brittle diabetic for 42 years now. At the time, I think it was, I don't know. I had very little schooling, so Carol can tell you my math is terrible. I was about 29, and I'm 61 now, so it was 1979. A phone call came into his apartment, and one of the paramedics answered the phone. And right away, I was like, well, this is interesting, because I could hear the conversation through the wire. I could hear the person calling. And they said, do you know anything about this girl that's here? We found a dead. I was like, I'm not dead. It was strange. They took out equipment to, one of them had said, oh, she hasn't been gone for long because I was still warm. And so they put the paddles on my chest for the electric shock, whatever they call that. And at that point, I was saying, leave it alone. Like, I could tell that they were trying to restore it. I didn't want to go back into it. I was like, this feels, I feel good where I'm at. You know, it was like, leave it alone. And at that point, I studied a little bit about near-death experiences a long time after that happened. But I know that most people will go through a tunnel. And when I almost died 16 years ago, I had double kidney failure and congestive heart failure and lost my sight. I started entering into the tunnel of stars. So I know what it is. But the first time, I was instantly in another world. And it's like, it was like the Wizard of Oz, where you come out of black and white into color. And in mortality, I am scared to death of water. I won't even get into a hot tub. I will take a bath, but I won't get into a hot tub. But I was instantly standing by this gorgeous lake. And the feeling I had was I wanted to fall into it. It was so beautiful. It looked like a combination between liquid silver and crushed diamonds. And I knew if I went down into it that I could breathe under there, which is one of the interesting things about, I'll tell you lots of neat things about the spirit body. But so many things caught my eye. I was like, I just wanted to see everything. I didn't have one care about the fact that I had departed Earth, that I had left three children behind, family, friends, antiques, whatever. Even my beloved Siamese cat at the time didn't care. This was such a fantastic place. As I turned my head away from the lake was to the right of me. I was standing right to the left, and it had these flowers that went all along the side of the lake that curved where I couldn't see past that because there were hills. And I was so curious about seeing everything, and I noticed there were just fields and fields and fields of the most beautiful flowers, and they're colors that we don't have in this world. I can still see them, but I don't have names for them, or I can't describe them. It's kind of like being blind from birth and trying to tell somebody what red is. I can't tell you, but they are so beautiful, colors that we don't have here. Just fields and fields of this plush, very brilliant grass. And the sky was, it wasn't blue. It looked like swirling clouds of light. It was so incredibly beautiful. I can't imagine any place on Earth that could look like this place. I saw a hill in the distance, and I thought, I want to go up on top of that hill. And I had no sooner said that I was on top of the hill. So I was starting to learn things about the spirit body. Number one, your eyes, your spiritual eyes, can see for long distances. It can move faster than the speed of light. You just have to think that you want to be there, and there you are. I didn't have to walk or glide, or I was just there. And when I got up to the top of the hill, far, far off in the distance, I could see a beautiful, beautiful city. It could have been 100 miles away, but I could see it very well. I looked about, and I saw this beautiful little cottage that far to the distance in the left, and it kind of looked like a Hansel and Gretel cottage, and it had like this little stone walkway, a stream that ran by it that had that silvery crystal water. And I thought, that's the kind of house I want to live in. I don't want one of those big mansions that I could see, those big buildings, and I'll tell you what they look like. I thought, this cottage was so beautiful. It probably wasn't that small, but it seemed like this little cottage. And the voice in my mind said, you can have that. You can have any house, any kind of house you want if you've earned it. Another thing that I learned. Then I saw just an ordinary dog. Alan, my publisher and friend, I kind of described it and he showed me some pictures and we kind of thought it looked like an Irish setter. It was trotting down the path and it looked over at me, and in my thoughts, the telepathic communication, the dog seemed happy to see me, like almost mentally welcoming me there. And I said, are there pets here? In the spirit world, when you ask a question, you don't just get one answer. You get many answers to the same question. So it's like seeing it from all directions. So I learned a lot about animals there. Anyone that knows me knows I'm an animal. I love animals more than people. Does that sound terrible? And I love people. But I also learned that God loves these animals more than we know. And I'd always grown up with pet and loved them before, but now I have a 150-pound German Shepherd and a 1-pound Chihuahua, a Siamese cat and a black cat, and a 45-pound raccoon. And if my health were better and I could see better, I'd add an alpaca and a squirrel and, you know, anything I could add. I love them. So I'm a big animal activist, you know, like, don't kill them. I learned very strongly that there are severe consequences for people who harm animals and kill them. Oh, I was going to tell you something. I thought, I better not do that. They won't like me anymore. I told a friend, I said, I think they should have the death penalty for people that torture and kill animals. I have no mercy where that's concerned. But anyway, I learned a lot about animals, and I learned that when you have stewardship over a pet in this life, that pet will be with you in the world to come, and they will find you there. You don't have to be looking for your pets or your loved ones. There's like what I call the spiritual radar, where they know you're there and they find you. And that was a great comfort to me, because I'd had so many critters growing up, frogs and turtles and cats and everything you could think of, baby duck. And so I was happy to learn that. I looked down into this beautiful city. My eyes could focus like a telephoto lens. And I could see it like I was standing close to it. And yet I knew I was quite a distance. The buildings, they're very shimmery, very brilliant. To me, they look like this light pink hue of alabaster marble, but so thin I could see through the buildings. Or maybe it's just because your spiritual eyes can see through buildings. And I could see all kinds of activities. I could hear music playing in the building. I saw this beautiful library with these huge, gorgeous books. I don't know what they were bound with, but I noticed there were no chairs there. There were tables and rows and rows and rows of these beautiful books. And I understood, I learned too much to tell you in one evening, but when you cross to the other side, I was only there for 7 minutes, but I learned more than I could learn being here in a lifetime. Just in a few minutes, I learned how pyramids were built. I saw other things which I never have shared and probably won't today either, but learned incredible things. So I knew that there was learning, and you learn much more rapidly over there. Because I started asking questions about what was going on there, the city, the people and everything. And I noticed as I asked questions, I could ask more than one question at a time. And I could get several answers at the same time and assimilate everything perfectly. So it's like the spirit mind, wow, we're such clay people down here. People that are clay people here on earth are those that just go through life partying and seeing what they collect and having fun, and they don't really do any good on earth, and they don't help other people. They're called exoikois, which was a very strange word, but that was associated with the clay people. The planet is full of clay people. More clay than, a lot of clay people. Then I saw into a room, which struck me a little unusual, were a lot of ladies. It looked like they were preparing fruit on these big, beautiful trays. I think it was fruit. One of them looked like a hard-boiled egg, only it had little craters in it. And the one lady, they're all so happy and having so much fun. And she would cut off slices of this thing. And every once in a while, she'd take a bite of it. And you could just tell that it was like, oh, that's so good. And so as I was standing on the hill, I said, I wonder what that tastes like. I wish I could taste that. And just out of nowhere, I could taste it in my mouth. It's incredible. The only thing I can kind of equate it to is maybe baklava that kind of melts in your mouth. Only it's so much better than that. So I understood that they eat there. They eat for pleasure, not for sustenance. They do not eat meat. There'll be no killing of animals or anything like that in the world to come. But they do eat for pleasure, and there's no waste. Everyone that I saw in the city, every person, they were beautiful. Everybody, the men, the women. I mean, they were, it's like seeing Angelina Jolie everywhere. I mean, just everybody was so beautiful, which gave me an understanding of, regardless of what shape our faces or bodies are here, that we are beautiful spiritual beings. And we will be that again when we leave this mortal tabernacle. Everyone is beautiful. No person should ever think, I'm not as pretty as this person. I'm not. You're all absolutely divine, just beautiful. Everyone was happy. I saw into another room, which seemed very strange. And Carol and I have just recently been watching something on Bio Channel on Sunday. They play different people's near-death experiences, and it's so neat. I have really enjoyed that because we're sitting there and go, yeah, yeah, you know that, yeah. I'm telling her, yeah, I know that. Huh. Get really excited because somebody else is, like our friend that was explaining in the beginning, there are many common threads with people's near-death experiences, although they can vary, like he said. One of them was I saw into this room, and remember I used to think that's so strange, and yet they kind of talked about it in a few of these programs that we just watched. I saw like this huge screen, only it wasn't like a screen like we have here. It looked like it was made out of like a clear gel. It was moving, but it didn't melt or dissipate. Very curious. And there was a man in it, in the screen. It had kind of this interesting modular chair in front of it. And the man was, he had these beautiful colored crystals. And he would drop them down into these holes. And I said, what are they doing? Because I could see this man on the screen. And the answer came to me, the man who is alive on earth is repenting and it's being blotted out. It's being blotted out. Then at that point, I was thinking of all the crummy stuff I had done in my life. Because of all the things that had happened to me growing up, I was a really hateful person. Every once in a while, she kind of sneaks back. I get impatient, but I love people. I'm a total different person than I was before this experience. But I don't think I was very nice before. I didn't really care about other people. I kind of had the attitude it was a dog-eat-dog world, and you've got to look out for yourself. And yes, they're suffering, but so am I. So I wasn't very compassionate then. And I started thinking about my life and what did my life mean? I hadn't done anything special or helped anyone. And I started thinking about my mistakes, and this window, this screen opened up to me. Everyone that crosses will have a life's review at some point. I don't know how long I was there because there's no concept of time there. I don't know if I was there for a few minutes. It seemed like hours, but no concept of time. And I was able to see my life's review. One of the greatest lessons that I learned, which I still have to battle, but more so in the last couple of years, life still isn't easy. I still have challenges. I had some of my worst experiences after I came back from my near-death experience. But anyway, in my life's review, I saw many of the mistakes that I had made, including being in Hollywood and whatever. I dated two or three very famous actors that used to be important back in those days and ride in limousines and things. And I thought that was a big deal. It's totally insignificant to me now. I had had sexual relationships when I wasn't married. I wasn't a religious person. I really didn't think there was a God. And at the time when I took my life, I didn't believe there was anything after that. And I didn't care. I just wanted it all to end. One of the things I learned in my life's review, what they call pains of the heart, we hurt people all the time and we're not aware of it. I had an experience, it's really painful for me now. It doesn't seem like a big do, but I had the impression that it was worse than the fornication that I had committed. Because I didn't have the understanding that that was wrong. That's a typical lifestyle in Hollywood. But I had the feeling that what I had done in high school was far worse than that. Not telling you that that's okay, it's not. But there was a girl in high school. And because I had lived in foster homes, I was called a rag doll and white trash most of my life, and kids making fun of me, and had very low self-esteem. I went into a foster home, my foster sister Joanne, her beautiful picture is in the book. They lived in a beautiful home in Mar Vista, California. It was the first time I'd ever been in a home that was lovely like that. The mother cooked health foods, and Joanne was gorgeous, and she had all these beautiful clothes, and she was so generous, and she said, anything you want to wear of mine. I came with two cotton dresses and a pair of tennis shoes. She said, you could wear anything that I have. And I was just like, wow. So coming from a life where people made fun of me, called me a rag doll and everything else, here I lived in this beautiful home as a foster teen with this beautiful foster sister and her beautiful clothes. And we were kind of in the in crowd. And I was accepted because I was Joanne's foster sister. And there was this girl that was in our school. The kids all made fun of her. And she kind of had facial hair. And the kids would, in front of her, go, Rachel, bzz, like, you need to shave. And Joanne and I would do it behind her back. We never did it to her face. But the terrible part was, I was able to feel what Rachel was feeling. We would plan these parties and invite all the in kids. And she would be there, and we'd never ask her if she wanted to come. I was able to feel Rachel's pain as though I were Rachel. It was so hurtful to me to see what we had done to her and that I didn't help her. And you talk about these kids bullying everybody in school today. They have no idea what they're doing. And my pain was so great. From that, I wanted to take it back. I couldn't change it. And the pain was so great. Just over something like that. Can you imagine? People that really hurt people. I've tried to find her for 30, 40 years. I can't find her. She may have already crossed over. And she'll know how sorry I am. Carol will, she's not there, she'll tell you, I will walk over glass to not hurt people's feelings. And every once in a while I say something that's not kind, or I jump on somebody and I feel so bad. Please don't hurt each other. At the point where I felt like I was going to disintegrate, I just felt such shame and such pain. In the far-off distance, I could see this light coming into the city. and it got brighter and brighter. And there were just myriads of people coming from out of the city, gathering around this light. And as it got closer into the city, there was a being in the light. He was so bright, so brilliant. And these beams of gold shot out of his body for miles. And there was like gold dust fragment shooting out of these beams. And I understood that even though he couldn't be right next to us, that these beams, these fragments touch us. It was Christ. It was Jesus that I never believed in my whole life. He was beautiful, beautiful. And although he never looked up at me, he didn't speak to me. He didn't see me, but he knew I was there. And I felt this incredible love for him. And I knew that he loved me regardless of all the crummy stuff I had done. That he loved me with a pure love that I never knew existed. And I wanted so much to go down into the city and see him. And there's many other things. There's so much I could tell you, but I can't keep you here all night. Or can I? I wanted to go see him so bad, but as I was thinking about going down into the city, I wanted him to hold me and tell me that it was going to be okay, because here I was on the other side and I couldn't undo all the crummy stuff I'd done in my life. And at that moment, I saw a woman walking up from behind me in the back of my head. So I realized spirit body can see in all directions. And I turned around and she called me by name. She said, Linnell, that's my birth name. What are you doing here? It's not time for you to be here. You have to go back. And before I had a chance to say, who are you and how do you know my name? She was beautiful. Okay, I can backtrack a little bit and tell you this. She had on a very pale, like peach, very soft color dress. They don't all wear white. There's a lot of beautiful pastels. And she had this beautiful cummerbund around her waist. When I was telling you that people had different illuminations in the city, different brightnesses coming out of them. Some were very bright and some less bright. The answer I got was it was in direct correlation to how they'd lived their lives while they were on earth. That you could look at somebody and tell everything about them, read them perfectly by their light. But anyway, I didn't get a chance to say, who are you and how do you know who I am? But she was beautiful. Every one of them looked like they're about 29, 30 years old. Before I could find out who she was, I was like sucked in this, like a vacuum pulling me into this very, very, very dark space. And when I first arrived there, I thought animals were being tortured. I could hear this horrible crying and just... the sounds were like tortured animals, and I realized that I was in a hellish place, a type of spirit prison. And guess who was standing right next to me? My father. And for just a second, I was like, oh my gosh. I remember what I had said to him. The last word I said to him was, I hope you burn in hell, as he was dying. So there he was. He was paying the price for what he had done to people, but he was also very remorseful. Sorry, I feel faint again. I think when I get stressed, the blood doesn't go to my heart like it's supposed to. But if I die after this lecture, I'm going to a good place. Sorry. Anyway, I knew that he was suffering and I was sorry. No words were spoken. This was all mental. It was so dark, I couldn't see him, but I knew that he was standing next to me. And I felt the pain of the people there. And my one thought was, I feel so sad for these people. All of a sudden, out of a whole life of having no compassion or mercy, I suddenly had it for all these people, especially my father. And I always said, you know, I walked around my whole life carrying this sword of hate, and I felt God take it out of my hand. And I felt nothing but love for my father. And I wanted to help him. And I ask God, why would you put any of your children in a terrible place like this, no matter what they did? And the answer came to me, he didn't. They were drawn there because of their deeds. Their light is so low that they cannot endure the light that's in paradise. There are different levels to where certain beings with a lesser light cannot move forward, but those from higher can come down. They were drawn there because of their deeds. And they have to go through every, like I saw Rachel and felt her pain, every one of them that had hurt people, had molested children, who had killed, who had done things, have to go through exactly what their victims had gone through. They feel it as though they were that person. And it's really painful. If I felt what I did by hurting Rachel in high school, I just got a second of being able to feel what my father was feeling, and I couldn't handle it. And that's why the hate was taken away. I ask God, do I have to stay in this place because I committed suicide? I thought, I can't stay here. It's so awful. And then I got tons of information about suicide. Now here's where, you know, people that have different near-death experiences learn different things, and I'm not negating or taking away from someone else's experience. But I went to a lady's lecture a couple of years ago that said, for whatever reason you commit suicide, you're doomed to hell. I was like, that's not what I learned. There are many different kinds of suicides, and only God can judge why somebody does that. I think I was so clinically depressed, I was not in my right thinking. And I think that's one of the reasons. I know there's another type of suicide where somebody may kill people and they don't want to go to jail, so they turn the gun on them. There's people that are influenced by psychotropic drugs that aren't in their right thinking. There's so many things that we cannot judge. We cannot judge. And just because that happens, no, they are not doomed. There is still redemption. There is for all of God's children. He loves every one of us so deeply, we'll never know till we see him face to face how much he loves and cares. Knows each of us by name. We are his children. I know that he's with me every moment of my life now. He's saved my life so many times. Even after my near-death experience, I'm not going to get into what happened after that. You'll have to read it in the book or listen to the radio show. I cried out, I want to go back to that other place, to that spirit world place. Please let me go back there. Let me go back there. And I had the impression, can't go back there. Not time for you to be there. And I begged, let me go back. And this view opened up. And I was able to see future world events, things that were coming in the future. I believe I was able to see that so that I would want to come back to Earth to take care of my three children, to prepare them for what I could see was coming. I woke up in an LA hospital. I was so dysfunctional that even after this remarkable experience, it took me about 3 years to get my act together. From years of, like I said, I'm still scared to drive in a fast car. I have a lot of little phobias from childhood. I sleep with a light on. Of course, I'm legally blind too, and I can't see in the dark. I have to sleep with the light on. I'm so thankful that God the Father gave me another chance. My girlfriend said in the car, and she's much more generous than she should be, she said, I pray all the time that I can be as nice to people as you are, and I'm not all the time. I lose my patience just like all of us do, say things I don't mean. People think that when people have a near-death experience, they're going to be perfect because they've seen all this, they've seen God, they're perfect. It's not true. I am still not the person I would like to be, although I'm totally different than what I was. 4 years after my near-death experience, we had to put my mother in a rest home because none of the girls could care for her. We had to work and she slipped into a coma. She was in a coma for 8 years before she passed. I held her as she died. It was a wonderful experience. My friend that was standing outside the door, she said, I heard you sobbing when your mother died. I'm so sorry. And I said, oh, I wasn't crying because she passed away. I was crying because I'm so happy where she is. I know where she is. I'm happy that she's released from all of this. God lives, my friends. And this life isn't just to collect material things, to have fun. I am thankful for everything I went through because now I can turn around and counsel other people that are hurting and have problems. And I've had people in wheelchairs and things come up to me and say, I didn't want to live anymore, but you've given me strength to go on. I'm thinking, how could I have helped them if I didn't understand where they were coming from? For those that have read my book, you know that I was raped and stabbed. My son was kidnapped and missing for 10 years. For a lousy little, not a full stop in California, I was arrested and handcuffed and in Sybil Brand jail in East LA, which is one of the worst women's facilities in California, for a $20 traffic ticket. I wasn't speeding. I didn't see the four-way stop. I had a producer in California say I'd like to do a TV movie week of the week about that. I was too traumatized. I don't care how much money I would make or whatever. I just couldn't go over everything that had happened in there. It's a book in and of itself. All of these things happened after my near-death experience. I lost my sight. I take 8 shots a day. See the bruises on the end of my fingers? I can't see them. You probably can. On my arms from 8 shots a day. I can't see. My friend has to take me everywhere. One day I feel okay. The next day I don't feel well at all. I never know from day to day. I've been having heart problems the last year. That's part of what my problem is tonight. And I'm a-okay with it. Every time I've told the Lord, I'll take whatever you give me, I decided to stop doing that. But he knows what's best for us. The things that we think that are trials and so hard for us will make us strong, especially when we know that he is there and he's mindful of us and our needs. I know that God lives and I believe in Jesus Christ. And I'm so thankful that I had this experience. Thank you for coming tonight.
So, is all the negativity that you went through necessary for you to have seen the city of light? Is it the yin and yang? Is it the light and dark? Was it a prerequisite for you to go so low in order for you to go so high?
No.
Okay.
No.
So, it's not necessary. You can just go high.
Good people, you live a good life, you do the best you can, whether you believe in God or not, will be in paradise. Those that attend or have to enter into the spirit prison are those that have really done bad things to other people. And they have to go through that process of understanding what they've done. The only way they can truly understand and be sorrowful for it is to know by feeling what they've done. But no, most of us will be in paradise together. So no, you don't have to go through trials and whatever to be there. There are many good people that go through life and don't have these kinds of experiences for whatever reason. I think the scriptures say God chastens those he loves, so I know he loves me.
In the city that you went to when you crossed over, were there children that you seen there, or were they just all adults?
No, there were just adults. My personal belief and understanding is, and I know this differs from other people, because people have died and said they saw children there. But I know from one thing that I learned is that you can see things that will benefit you for a particular reason. Like you will be able to see a child or children because you need to see that. Spirits can take different forms. It's like, oh gosh, how do I explain this? No. When we leave our bodies, we're adult spirits. But in the resurrection, if you pass away in that little tiny body, which I do believe in a resurrection, the spirit will enter back into that little tiny body and the mother will be able to raise that child to adulthood. But there are no children there. Just like the Hansel and Gretel cottage, I think I was meant to see that. It's not that it's actually there and someone's living in it. I think that was meant to be seen for my purpose, for me. Let me just touch on one thing quickly. I saw a couple of men in suits, which stood out like a sore thumb. What is that about? The answer that came to me is they were going to be appearing to someone on earth, and in order for them to be recognized, they were dressed that way.
Okay. I had a question about, you said you were wanting to prepare your children. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what specifically is most important to you to teach and prepare your children for the future?
Well, I think the most important thing is to teach your children that there is a God, especially in the world that we live in today. They need to know that there's something more than this life. I've talked to a lot of people in LA over time, and especially in the last few months, and they're so distraught with everything that's going on. I've heard a friend say, some of my friends just don't even want to live anymore because of what's happening. I'm like, no, you can't have that attitude. And when I talk about last day's events, go, I don't want to be there for that. I'm like, are you kidding? We're going to see Christ return to earth. This is an exciting time to be alive. But I do believe in preparation. I'm not going to go into last day's events, but they did tell me that I am associated with a food storage company. I don't sell the food. I have nothing to do with that. It is called securityfoods.shelfreliance.com. You can buy from any company you want. All I will tell you is I have 21 years food storage. One of the things I saw was people digging in the earth for worms to eat. A great famine is coming, and it would be a very wise thing to do. So that's as far as I'll go on that. Teach your children that there is a God.
Okay, well, my question is, since you're here and talking like you are, I lost my wife 2 years ago, this October 30th. When I pass away, will she be there waiting for me?
Yes. Now, if you have a lengthy illness, like you're in a hospital bed or you don't die instantly, she will be right there in the hospital room waiting for you, along with several other relatives that you've never even met will be right there. If you go quickly, well, let me tell you, the woman that approached me in the spirit world, 4 years after my near-death experience, when we put my mother in the rest home, we went through all of her belongings. I'd never seen photo albums before. I never met my grandmother. I asked my oldest sister, I said, who is this woman in this photo album? This is the woman that told me I had to go back, called me by name. It was my grandmother, Sarah. That's when I changed my name to Sarah. So they are aware that you're there right away. But if you have a lengthy illness and you pass, they're right there waiting before you even pop out. And let me tell you, the death experience I say this and people think it's strange. It will be the most beautiful experience you've had in your lifetime. It feels so good to be free and to move with the speed of light and all of the capabilities and the feeling of peace and love. It's wonderful. Death is nothing to fear. And our loved ones, I talk quite a bit about it in the book. They are very aware of your lives. They're not just standing there watching everything you do, thank goodness. But they're very aware of how your life is doing, and they visit more often than you are aware of. Every once in a while, you'll feel their presence. They will return for important events, weddings. You know, my husband passed away, gosh, is it 7 years ago or about 7 years ago? My brother, my sister, lots of friends. Yeah, they'll be right there when I'm ready to go over again. So, and she's very aware of your life. And you can be very happy for her that she's in that beautiful place. Okay.
Sarah, you mentioned this cottage that you saw and had a desire for. And you were told that you could have, you know, any kind of home up there, but you had to earn it. Well, I have some general assumptions how you do that. Specifically, how do you earn it?
Well, I think what they were trying to say is you have to be a half-decent person. I mean, it's not like, oh, I did better than you, so I'm going to have a bigger house. I think what they were saying is you can have the desires of your heart. I learned so many neat things, like I love antiques. I don't love anything modern except for my big screen TV. Because I don't go anywhere. I go to church on Sunday and Carol takes me to Walmart once a week. And that's it. I don't go anywhere. So for me, and I sit 2 feet away from this big screen TV in order for me to be able to see it and then can't read captions or anything like that. But I love old things, antiques. And I learned that, I was thinking one time, I thought, well, it'd be kind of sad to leave my pretty antique furniture. It looks like 18th century stuff. I love old things. That's why I'm so fond of myself. But I feel so old. That they can actually reproduce everything on the other side. There are great artisans and craftsmen and scientists, and they can reproduce everything that you love here. You don't lose anything. This is my mother's cameo. She never had anything beautiful. My father gave her this during World War II. She gave it to me 20 years before she died because she knew my sisters would take it away from me. It's my most prized possession. It's the only thing I have of hers. You know, we do have sentimental connections with things that we have here, but everything will be replaced. We will never lose anything. Never lose anything.
I have a quick question. These are wonderful spiritual experiences you taught us about, but you did say something about the physical things you saw. In particular, you said you saw how the pyramids were created. Scientists all guess at that. I was there a year or two ago. What can you tell us about that? How did that happen?
Well, I'm not going to take a lot of time talking about pyramids, but what I could see were these huge skins that were joined together, huge skins of animals that were very strong, with ropes attached, and through wind velocity, wind power, they were able to guide the stones into the places. Through wind power. Anyway, it seems pretty simplistic, but in the desert, there's winds that come up that are quite horrific. And we're talking about thousands of people holding and controlling and guiding, but that's how they were able to place the stones.
Okay. I got a comment with that'll lead to a question. I've studied ancient artworks and rituals and near-death experiences from an ancient point of view. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I find interesting in early to later Christian artworks and rituals is this idea of the afterlife journey. The soul is symbolically clothed in a different types of colors of garments, and the different types of colors of garments or robes or clothing on through white, all through the shades of spottedness and blackness represent the types of sins you've accumulated. And it seemed to, when you talked about the aura or the type of light that people radiate from them represented the degree of righteousness or wickedness.
How they'd lived their lives.
Would you think maybe that the ancients knew about near-death experiences in that type of way with symbolical color symbolism?
I'm sure they did. I mean, people have been having near-death experiences practically from the beginning of time. Millions of people have near-death experiences. Many people don't share them or are uncomfortable. I'm not uncomfortable. I get emotional about a few of the parts in my near-death experience. But I didn't see any black there, any black clothing of any kind. There were a lot of pastel, very pale pastel robes. I learned that when you enter into the spirit realm, you go in without clothes on, by the way, but you don't feel uncomfortable. I would now. I'm 20 pounds overweight. But anyway, it's all insignificant. They give you new entrance robes when you enter into the spirit world. Everyone in the city knows that you've just arrived, that you've newly crossed over, and they're very helpful with everything. So you have a new spirit entrant robe. Then you move on to different clothing after you've been there. But I never felt like the color of clothing had anything to do with importance or how they'd lived their lives. It's just a choice.
A person who has lived a bad life and they die and experience a near death, where is it they go? Do they go to the higher realm or do they go to the lower realm if they're given that opportunity to come back? And then my second question is it possible to have experienced a near death and not know it?
Okay, number one, I want to make sure I've got this clear. You're saying if they've lived a bad life, they cross over, but then come back, where do they go? It depends on how they live their life after they've come back.
So if they've lived such a bad life, why are they given the opportunity to come back?
Well, because it's not merited on if you were good or bad. It's just not your time. There is a time allotment for all of us. And actually, there is a building there, a hall of records, that actually has your death date of your appointed time. You can cut that short by driving 90 miles an hour down the freeway or doing drugs or whatever. You can cut that time short. You can also have loved ones on the other side go to a commission to ask for you to cross over sooner because they want you on the other side or need you. But we all have an allotted time to figure it out here, and God is merciful to give us that time. But you can't procrastinate. I mean, hopefully we can learn to be better people while we're here. The other thing is, if you've lived a rotten life and you didn't really, I mean, we all have an innate sense of what's right or wrong, regardless if you've ever been taught anything or not. But if you've crossed over and you really didn't have the great opportunity, God is very merciful and they will have a chance to be elevated, but they need to experience the wrong that they've done and truly be remorseful and be ready to move forward. Does that answer it? And then what was your second one, honey?
My second question is, could you have had the experience and not known that you've had one?
You know, people have what's called an out-of-body experience where they can see their body, but they don't go to another world or whatever. And yes, I think they can. One of my best friends had a deadly motorcycle accident where she almost died. She vaguely remembers seeing a bunch of people that wanted her to come with them, but she had a choice, but that's about all she remembers. But when she came back from that, she was a total different person. So I think she had an experience, but for whatever reason, wasn't allowed or didn't remember it. So yeah, I think you can.
The times that are the chain of events that are beginning, and obviously many of us hear many things, hear prophecies, read things, you know, there are warnings in the general public. And we are concerned and need to prepare for the future. Mm-hmm. But sometimes we feel so overwhelmed and so caught up in our daily lives. What do you feel has been the most helpful steps that you've taken to weather through these very difficult times, short of preparing certain things? What are key things that you focus on to help you get through these difficult times?
Well, I, for one, am not afraid because I know that God is in control. And even though the dark one, the adversary, is doing a very good job right now, I'm not talking about President Obama. Although, don't get me on that subject. Anyway, what I was going to say is God is in control. There are things that are going to happen that are uncomfortable. I think the most important thing is to have a relationship with God. We all pray and beg for help when we're going through a hard time, but what kind of relationship do we have with him every day when everything's fine? We need to know him and have that relationship with him and know that he is watching over us. And if we've done what we're supposed to be doing and we have a close relationship, he's going to take care of us. The other thing is a physical preparation. I do believe in being physically prepared too. So spiritual, number one, the relationship with God. Number two is be prepared. Has anybody gone and seen the movie Contagion?
No.
Well, it's interesting. I do believe that's coming. I won't get into that, but today. But one of the things that was really pointed out in the movie was people were trying to get food. So I think it's important. Anything else?
Let's give a thanks to Sarah for coming and